Thank you, Deputy Chief French. Before we go to questions, I want to give the ranking member of the subcommittee, Mr. Magoose, an opportunity for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your indulgence. Today's hearing gives our subcommittee another opportunity to continue the critical discussion about our national response to the wildfire crisis. As we know, well back in my district, just by way of example, in Colorado, climate change is leading to longer and more severe fire seasons, and we must respond accordingly. That's exactly why House Democrats took significant steps in the 117th Congress to secure historic investments for the Forest Service and the Department of Interior through the bipartisan infrastructure law, and I thank the Deputy Secretary for his testimony and for being here today. Specifically, we provided $28 billion to the Department of Interior and $5.5 billion to the Forest Service to address drought, fire management, forest and landscape resilience, and preservation for increasing extreme weather events. We delivered further with the Inflation Reduction Act, which provided $2.5 billion for ecosystem resilience and restoration, as well as a $500 million allocation for wildfire management and workforce needs. These historic investments allowed the Biden administration to develop and implement the National Cohesive Wildland Fire Management Strategy, leading to record-high restoration treatments designed to promote resilient landscapes and safe communities. Another key accomplishment was the establishment of the Wildland Fire Mitigation and Management Commission, which at the end of the last year released their final report that includes a whopping 148 consensus recommendations. I want to thank the commission for appearing before the bipartisan Wildfire Caucus, of which I serve as a co-chair. We are lucky enough, I understand, to have two members of the commission who are testifying today, and I certainly want to thank all of the members of the commission for their time and their continued efforts to advance and advocate for a comprehensive wildland fire response and pre-fire preparedness. We have a lot of work to do, as we are now challenged to translate those recommendations from the commission into action. Fortunately, several bills that have been sponsored by members of this body align with the recommendations advanced by the commission. I introduced with a number of my colleagues a bipartisan bicameral Joint Chiefs Reauthorization Act, as well as the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Program Reauthorization Act, both of which I think are important steps forward for restoration efforts. I hope the chairman will consider including those bills, among many others, within the discussion draft that he has released and that we're considering today. There are a number of other consensus-driven bills that I think merit some consideration by this committee, both as standalone measures and, of course, with respect to the bill that we're considering from the chairman. Before getting into the details of the discussion draft, I do just want to say I appreciate the chairman's interest and his focus, lifetime focus on forestry and wildfire. I know it's an issue that's near and dear to the chairman as the only registered forester in the United States Congress. And while we may not see eye to eye on every provision of his discussion draft, it is encouraging, I think, to see some new and revamped pieces of the bill that sync up with several of the recommendations made by the Wildfire Commission. Just by way of example, the establishment of a Fire Environment Center, or Fire Shed Center, as it is called in the chairman's bill, is in line with several consensus recommendations of the report. The focus on community wildfire risk reduction has the potential to build on the Community Wildfire Risk Reduction Grant Program that we established last Congress. Now, we do have concerns, and there have been a variety of concerns articulated by different organizations. I'll ask unanimous consent at the conclusion of my remarks to enter their letters into the record, and I look forward to the robust discussion that we're going to have today. I think that this issue has to be approached in a bipartisan way because it is a bipartisan priority. And so certainly the chairman has my commitment as the ranking member to work in good faith, and I know that he shares that same commitment. The last thing I will just say, I mentioned at the top of my remarks, but I'm grateful to the Forest Service. You all are doing tremendous work because of the investments that House Democrats made in the last several Congresses. I should say with the leadership of my colleague, Mr. Peters, who has waved onto the committee today and who's been a national leader in this space. The Forest Service has achieved annual records for hazardous fuels reduction and prescribed burning. And again, that's because of the investments that were made in the Inflation Reduction Act. So I see that I am at the conclusion of my time. Again, I thank the chairman for holding this important hearing, and I look forward to the testimony and the questions. I yield back.
Thank the ranking member. Without objection, we'll accept your submission to the record. It's now time for questions, and we'll start with the gentleman from Utah, Mr. Curtis. You're recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to echo the thoughts and appreciation to you for bringing this forward and to being such a leader on this. I'd like to quickly nod to the ranking member, Congressman Neguse, in your comments about bipartisanship. You know, you and I are interesting. We share a boundary. And while the politics might be very different on each side of this boundary, the geography is very similar. And we both deal with these forest fires in our district of great magnitude. And it's been an honor to serve as your co-chair on the Wildfire Caucus and appreciate your leadership there. And I think one thing in particular I'd like to point out is your leadership in making sure that those who fight our fires are appropriately compensated. And just a moment of a shout out to these good men and women who oftentimes sacrifice their health and safety to protect us, to protect our property and our lives. And we've seen that in Utah firsthand. And so a big shout out to all of them. It's been said, and we all know, that we don't have fire seasons anymore. We have fire years. And it's just a reality that we're facing. And this is particularly acute in the West and in my district. And clearly, we all know this, but let me point out that what we're talking about impacts water supply, air quality, recreation, ranching and grazing, and for many people, their way of life. And just as many, many ways, this is important. I'd also like to point out that oftentimes we overlook the wisdom of people who live in these areas. And I think sometimes they can give us a lot of insight on how to fight these. I'm proud to support the chairman with this legislation. And Mr. French, just a couple of questions. It does come down sometimes to partisanship and being proactive versus reactive in these fires. And can you just talk for a minute about where the sweet spot is on being proactive and what you would like to see us consider?
Well, okay. It is so much more efficient to the American taxpayer to reduce wildland fire risk in the forests and grasslands. I mean, you look at what happened in Texas this year. To do that preventatively, when you look at the rate of return versus the impacts that happen to a community from a wildfire, and honestly to our resources, it's a no-brainer to me. And I think sometimes we forget the broader consequences of getting our forests back into healthier conditions. The downstream effects of water. The number of users that depend on water from LA all the way up through most of California, like 50% of the groundwater that goes into municipal water supplies in the West originates from national forests. So I think we often think about just the impacts at a local community, but it's so much broader. It's the food we eat. It's the communities that depend on the water. And every time we lose the ability to deliver one of those, the costs are enormous compared to the investment of reducing that risk up front. So the sweet spot to me is our ability to recognize we have to continue our suppression work. We have to. But to make the right investments at the right scales, at the right pace, up front to actually make sure that these forests are surviving for generations to come. And right now they're at risk.
Yeah, thank you. You know, you mentioned water, and I have to think, you know, one of the biggest problems in my community after a devastating fire would be the floods and mud debris Sure. that come down when that, and the erosion when that growth is taken away. If I can compel all of my residents to listen to this testimony today, and you have a moment to say to them what you would like them to do as residents in in places that that run up against these lands. What advice would you give? What proactive steps can residents take in prohibiting these fires?
Well, I'm going to answer it this way. I'm going to repeat to you what I told my own mother, okay, who lived for years in Heber, Arizona, right out some very large fires, who, as I walked her property, loved the environment around her. But the reality was, is that very environment on her property and the adjoining property would be cause her to lose her house. And so my advice to homeowners is look at your own property. Make sure that we are reducing the fire risks that you have right around your house. Do simple things if you can, or take advantage of what our fire safe councils and others are offering to harden your property. And then when you look at the surrounding lands, whether it is state, federal, county, or even private landowners, be a part of understanding what a healthy forest is. And most of our forests in fire-adapted areas right now, because we've excluded fires, and this is what I've told her, I'm like, that beautiful forest that you're looking at that you love is unhealthy. Yeah. It's unnatural.
I wish I could let you go on a little bit more, but I am out of time, and so I'm going to yield, Mr. Chairman.
Gentlemen, as time has expired, I recognize the ranking member, the gentleman from Colorado, Mr. Neguth, for 5 minutes.
I thank the chairman, and again, thank you for being here. Deputy Chief French, and I certainly want to echo the remarks of my colleague from Utah. We'll miss him here in the House, but I know he'll no doubt continue his efforts that have been so successful here in our body in partnering on a bipartisan basis to address wildfire risk, and it's certainly been a pleasure and a privilege for me as the co-founders of the Bipartisan Wildfire Caucus to work with him in that regard, although our ski resorts are still better than his. But anyway, not to offend the sensibilities of the crowd, apparently. Mr. French, I want to say I deeply appreciate the work that your agency does, deeply appreciate the work that Chief Moore does, and have certainly appreciated the partnership of the Forest Service. And so I want to preface my remarks with that statement. I have been frustrated by the inability to receive an answer from the Forest Service regarding some basic questions that myself and several other members of Congress have propounded to the agency in regards to wildland firefighter pay. As you know, we've worked with the agency for years, and we appreciate your partnership, and of course we understand that it takes Congress to act with respect to making permanent some of the pay protections that the Forest Service has been so passionate about. But one issue in particular that has percolated to our office and to others is housing. And a number of anecdotal reports of exorbitant housing increases for wildland firefighters that are barely making enough to get by. And I previously had another witness from the Forest Service who testified in a hearing in March, whom I questioned on this issue. We sent a letter in February. I don't know if you're aware of that letter. If you are, perhaps you can opine on that. And if not, I would love your commitment to go back to the agency to perhaps convey to them that one of their biggest advocates on Capitol Hill, someone who's worked very hard to try to increase funding for the Forest Service, is deeply disappointed in their inability to answer what were basic questions, essentially, about the housing rent increases for wildland firefighters that we've heard over the course of the last 6 months.
Fair enough. I do commit to that. I will go back and talk with the deputy chief area that oversees that. I apologize to you that we haven't given you a timely response. The rates that we have to charge for our housing are essentially set through policy that comes from the Office of Personnel Management. I will tell you that as a leader in this agency, it is very hard for me to understand why we have to charge certain rental rates that are not commensurate with the communities that we're a part of, but may be set on a community that is 100 miles away, like Bend, Oregon, where rental rates are going to be much higher versus a rural space that we'd be in. It is our central focus, and we've started to move some Great American Outdoors funds to address it. but the actual issue in terms of the rates that we're charging has been a central focus for Chief Moore and our leadership, and we will get you your answers.
I thank you, Deputy Chief, and I know this isn't your particular bailiwick in terms of your subject area, and I also know it's not the exact nature of the subject that we're discussing today, but I appreciate your commitment, and that's exactly why we're hoping for an answer from the agency, because we, and one of the questions was actually specifically around OMB's policies, because we think we can be a resource in perhaps advocating for changing some of those, either on the regulatory basis or perhaps via changes in statute. So I thank you. I thank the chairman. I yield back.
Gentleman yields back. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Oregon, Mr. Bentz, for 5 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also want to compliment you on this bill. I read it through this morning. It's an extremely focused and, I think, excellent approach to the challenges we face in our forests. To that end, I'm curious about how much progress the Forest Service has actually made over the past, let's say 5 years, in trying to reduce the danger of wildfire. Can you share with us what you think the progress has actually been on perhaps a percentage basis? Because you have millions of acres you're dealing with. Can you share with us how many thousands of acres the Forest Service has successfully reduced the level of fuel upon?
Yeah, so I think there's actually two ways to look at this. Last year we did, we reduced wildland fire risk on, I think, 4.3, somewhere right in there, million acres, which was a significant increase from where we were the year before.
And how many total acres are you dealing with in millions?
How many total, say that again?
How many total acres does the Forest Service manage?
There's 193 million acres.
Right, and how many did you take care of?
Last year, I think it was 4.3 million acres.
So there's a ways to go.
4.35.
You got a ways to go.
Let's
hop to the amount that wildland firefighters are paid. I had some contractors come in 2 weeks ago, I think, three maybe, from Oregon that contract with Forest Service and the BLM, and they had been told that they had to increase the pay of those that they hire when they're doing these kinds of contracts by something like $9 an hour, taking up the pay to around $35. Does that ring true to you?
I'm not aware of that, but I can get back with you.
So it is true. And the amount that's being paid now is somewhere in that mid $30 per hour range. I have actually fought fire, and frankly, $35 an hour I'm not sure I'd want to fight for $35 an hour, but the truth of it is that's a pretty good wage. Are you aware of people being paid more than that to fight fire, $35 an hour?
I also fought fire for the Forest Service. I am aware of other state agencies that are paying more. And I don't know what contractors are paying.
I don't think the Forest Service had much to do with the establishment of these rates. I think it was somebody else. And we'll probably hear about that later. But the that amount, that dramatic of an increase in that which has to be paid to those who are hired to try to help us, makes it extremely difficult for many of these companies to stay in business because it was done abruptly. And the amount that was of the increase was around 20%, maybe even 25 or 30% of what was normal. And I'll just point that out because it's going to be difficult for many of them to stay in business.
Okay.
And they are absolutely essential, these independent contracting groups, to controlling fire in and across the United States. They're absolutely essential. So you might want to look into that, and we better be talking to whoever's in charge of raising these rates, and I had it in my notes, but I'm in the office of somebody, and you might want to reach out and say, what are you doing? You're putting the nation at risk because these companies can't afford it. And so, I mean, that's just the way it is. Let me hop to NEPA for a moment and the lawsuits. Are you aware of lawsuits that have delayed? Are you aware of lawsuits that have delayed the Forest Service in trying to take care of dangerous situations, fire-related?
Am I aware of did you say ESA?
Sure, under the NEPA.
Delaying when we're actually suppressing fires?
No. In anticipation of cleaning up the forest, perhaps not have as many fires to fight.
Okay, yes. So, we have to consult with the ESA and on ESA with two agencies. And I would say historically, we've had projects that have been delayed in the last year or so. We've been working very collaboratively.
But let me I'm going to run out of time here. What I'm getting at, there's a provision in this bill, and it's an excellent one, that's doing its best to try to head off that kind of litigation. Yep. So that you can do your job and try to protect people in cities and towns. Are you being prevented from doing that by virtue of litigation?
Or in virtue of litigation?
Or the threat of lawsuits?
Litigation, for me, as overseeing and doing this work, litigation is a part of just our work, and I anticipate that in our timeframes and our costs.
Thank you. Yield back.
Chairman yields back. The chair recognizes the gentlelady from New Mexico, Ms. Ledger Fernandez, for 5 minutes.
Thank you so very much, and once again, welcome again, Deputy Chief French, and thank you for being here. As you know, April 6th marked the two-year anniversary of the Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon fire that was started by the Forest Service, prescribed burn, and devastated my home state of New Mexico and lands I hold dear. So every time I look at issues with regards to forest management, I come with those fresh burn scars in my memory. And I want to thank the Chair Westerman for drafting legislation to address these. And thank you so very much for incorporating some of my suggestions and other suggestions from the Democrat members of the committee. So while there are provisions in the bill that I think are transformational in terms of how we address and manage our forests, because responsibly and appropriately managing the forest, I think that there is consensus on that. There was an issue of how do we go about it. And one of the themes I think has come up with some of these questions is really about how do we pay for it all, right? How do we make sure that we pay enough so our firefighters are able to do their job so that people working on state fires aren't paid more, that there is enough so that we can get this done, because that doesn't get done in a vacuum. Mr. French, does the Forest Service have a big pot of money sitting around that they can utilize to get stuff done?
Well, it's been helpful under the bipartisan infrastructure law and IRA, but generally, no.
Right. So I wanted to see if you could comment. Yeah, and I think that was key. Like, we recognized in the bipartisan infrastructure law the need to send money to USDA, to the Forest Service, to start some of this transformational work that needed to be done, and to look at firefighter pay. And now we're trying to say, how do we get some of that and actually institutionalize it? But could you speak a bit on, in reviewing this, are there consequences for your agency, and would you be able to carry out some of the directives without funding resources to execute them?
As written right now, so here's the direct answer. Yes, we could carry them out, but it would come at a consequence of us not doing other things. I mean, that's what we do right now. We take the money we have and we focus on the priorities, and it may mean we're not delivering as much in other areas. You know, the other way to look at it is, no, we should. There are certain aspects of this that we would need more funding to carry out.
Right, and I think your comment earlier that if we put money up front, we're going to save money from suppression costs, which are much more expensive and have lots of other negative consequences for our economy. So when I see this, it's like we can't keep complaining about these issues and not fund the agencies to do their work.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the bill and IRA funding has been incredible. It's helped us really look at wildland fire risk reduction. But, you know, when you compare that, that's one-time temporary money. You can't hire the type of capacity you need long-term to actually sustain a response to this problem and fund the agency at a level long-term to actually deal that. So it's a different dynamic. I mean, we're dealing with right now on how to deal with, big budget shifts, cuts we just got and in our workforce, because that money was one-time money, right? So most of that goes out to contractors and others. But if you're going to build a workforce to sustain this work over time and deliver our full mission, whether it's providing timber, range management, recreation, all the things that we do, there has to be a sustained investment.
Right. And so I would encourage my colleagues to think about the need to actually fund the agencies to do the work that we are asking them to do, including in this legislation. We had I want to quickly ask that I know you did some planning with service-wide planning with regard to NEPA, the endangered species. Can you tell us quickly some of the accomplishments that you accomplished with that planning?
Yeah, so I mean, this has been a focus of mine for years. Over the last 10 years or 5 years, we've seen a relative decrease in our NEPA cost by about $10 million a year, yet we've been producing more. We're doing fewer decisions, using more authorities, but we're producing more. We have record amounts of hazardous fuels work, a million more acres this year than we had the year before. We've been holding steady on our ability to provide other outputs, and yet our costs for environmental compliance continue to go down. That's one aspect of it that I'm pretty proud of.
Yeah, part of that says is you don't need to get rid of environmental compliance. You can actually plan for it and get better results. Thank you for the biochar provisions in this bill. I learned a lot about biochar with you, Mr. Chair, and with that, I yield back.
The gentlelady yields back. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Minnesota, Mr. Stauber, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chairman Tiffany, for holding this. I want to thank you for convening this hearing. I want to thank the Chairman Westerman and the committee staff for their work on the legislation before us today. The district I represent in northern Minnesota is home to great timberland, including on federal lands like the Chippewa and Superior National Forests. Like many rural districts across the country, we face serious risks from wildfires if our forests are not properly managed. This legislation will help benefit the people of northern Minnesota and our vast public lands. One of the provisions that I am very happy to see included in this draft is the expansion of the Good Neighbor Authority to allow counties and tribes to fully participate. I'm happy to see my good friend, Representative Fulcher's Treating Tribes and Counties as Good Neighbors Act included in the text of this bill. I am proud to co-sponsor the standalone bill and want to thank Chairman Westerman for including it in his bill. Deputy Chief French, thank you for joining us once again today. The Chippewa and Superior National Forests are not currently meeting their timber harvesting goals. And this is having serious consequences. In August of 21, during the Greenwood Fire, nearly 27,000 acres burned in the Arrowhead region of northern Minnesota, most of that within the bounds of the Superior National Forest. And that was just 10 years ago, after the Pagami Creek Fire that burned just under 93,000 acres on the Superior National Forest. Deputy Chief French, timber harvesting is an important tool in preventing wildfires. One which I will add supports economic activity in communities like those in northern Minnesota and raises revenues that can be reinvested into forest management. Deputy Chief French, can you share why national forests like the Chippewa and Superior are not meeting their timber harvesting goals, their 100% of the allowable sale?
Sure. First of all, I'd say over the last 10 years, we've increased our timber volumes out of the agency about 15%, while the budget that we've had for that, for specifically for timber,
Mr. French, I'm just specifically talking about the Superior and Chippewa, not overall forest.
Well, I'm going there.
Okay.
So the bottom line is staffing. The overall budget we've had in forest products has remained relatively flat in that same period, whereas the increase of costs for personnel and things like that. We had nearly a 10% increase in salaries that we had to pay for last year, but the budget remains flat. So at the end of the day, the amount of staffing we have to carry out this work, and we've been investing in that region, in their area, but chronically they tell us they don't have quite the number of funds they need.
So how much staff do you need? By the way, I'm not sure I agree with that answer, but how much staff do you need to make sure the Superior and Chippewa are harvesting 100% of the allowable sale?
I'll have to get back to you. I don't know the specific numbers on that.
Are you seeing these same issues, Deputy Chief French, outside forest areas of Minnesota, like around the nation? Are you seeing short staffing causing the logging to be reduced?
Yes. I mean, it's a combination of three things. We've lost specific expertise and staffing in some areas. We've lost infrastructure in some areas, forest products infrastructure, where it's harder to utilize those pieces. And then the composition of things that we do offer, we're not offering as much in terms of saw logs and other pieces as we reduce wildland fire risk. And so that has consequences that we know in our own supply, and doesn't meet all those goals. The last thing I'd say is that those numbers that you talk about are allowable sale quantities. There's lots of other factors that had to go into how much we actually offer on forest to forest.
Would you consider getting some professional advice from the private industry?
Yes. And
which wouldn't cost the government anything.
No, and I will say that I've been making some of those moves to bring in folks from the private industry to give us advice on how to handle some things right now. So sure,
if I got a group together to work on the Superior and Chippewa from the private industry, you'd have an open door.
We have an open door to anything like that. What I would also suggest, though, is that managing forests on private lands versus managing lands through the federal laws and regulations and the multiple things that we have to do are quite different. And you're going to see different management.
So you're saying the federal government has redundancy in rules and regulations that hamper your ability?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying if you have a private land that you're managing towards the value primarily of economic timber versus the value of, let's say, wildlife, fisheries, water, tribal interests, there's a whole other set of interests that we have to manage on a national forest based on the laws that Congress has passed that are quite different than a private industrial landowner. And I think it's just a different space.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I see my time's up. I yield back.
Gentleman yields back. The chair recognizes the gentleman from California, Mr. Peters, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. French. I thought your testimony was very well done and very helpful. I'm also going to praise the Biden administration for what it's done with the IIJA, the infrastructure bill, and the IRA in terms of advancing action on climate. But I'm going to express to you the same frustration I've had with the administration I expressed to Mr. Ali Zaidi yesterday, which is accepting this litigation regime as a given. And you did that very professionally. You're not here to criticize NEPA or any other laws. You've described them as part of your timeline when you work. It's just part of the game. I've been asking the administration in other contexts to tell us what we could do to make it go faster. We are facing this climate challenge that we describe as something we have to act on in 10 years. In my other committee, Energy and Commerce, we deal with transmission. It takes 10 years to build a power line. You can't deploy significant renewables without doubling or tripling the size of the grid, and we are just not getting it done because we've burdened ourselves with such process. Out of the 10 years it takes to build a power line, 7 years are process, 3 years are construction, and you know we're not going to compete with China or solve the environmental crisis under that kind of regime. And it occurs to me that there are bedrock laws like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act that prevent the emission of pollutants into the air. But we've got these process laws like NEPA that we need to look at again. I look at the comments about Mr. Westman's draft, and a lot of it is just conclusory. Well, we can't change public access. We can't change access to the court, as if that's the game, as if NEPA was delivered to us on tablets from Moses. Right? Rather than, like IBM Selectric typewriters in 1970. That's what they had back then. People like us wrote that law. Those laws need to be adapted to today's challenge. And in the fire context, you can't be litigating over almost every tree. We cannot do that. I'm not asking you for a response. I'm telling you what I would like the Biden administration to tell me is how to make it better. This notion you can't go to arbitration or you can't go to an administrative proceeding instead of a federal court where it's the complaint sits on a desk for a year before it's picked up in the context of this, what we describe as an environmental crisis. And I'm asking the administration, I'll ask through you, I think we need to do better. I think we need to figure out a way, you know, where is this essential? Where is it adding to environmental protection? And also, as environmentalists, I practiced environmental law for 15 years. So I know a little bit about the NEPA style litigation. We gotta ask what the trade-offs are. And time is our enemy now. So I don't want you building in time. I mean, you have to do it now. I don't want you building in time for NEPA litigation that's not necessary. I want to get rid of that. And I don't want you building in time for reconsultation if that's a waste of time. I want to give more authority to the Forest Service to manage these things, to get these forests in a condition that would have existed had natural fire existed over the last century, because as I said before, we don't have natural fires anymore. We have catastrophes. Some people wonder why I, from San Diego, am worried about that. Well, we've had fires too, directly. We had fires in 2003 and 2004 when I was a member of this, or 2007 when I was a member of the city council, that took homes. And a lot of what we couldn't get out of our way on brush management, like you described with your mom. Just because I'm next to the ocean, I wouldn't claim the ocean as my district, right? The oceans and the forests are natural systems that affect the entire world. We've all got to be in this game. And I'm just not going to sit here and say that the way we've done it always is the way we should do it, just because we've always done it always. And some of these arguments I see, I'll just let people know who are here, are very conclusory, like as though expanding categorical exclusions in itself is an argument that persuades me. It doesn't. If expanding categorical exclusions is a way we can help these forest systems be healthy, I'm all for it, because I'm for the environment, not for these 50-year-old environmental laws that were appropriate in 1970, but often don't meet the challenge, and in fact, ironically, undermine the challenge of environmental protection today. So I'm happy to have this conversation start off today, and Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman, I look forward to participating, and thanks again for letting me participate in this hearing, and I yield back.
Gentleman yields, and I'll recognize Representative Westerman for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman Tiffany, and again, thank you, Mr. French, for being here today. You said something in your testimony that I've said many times in this room before. It's the old metaphor that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that's probably nowhere more evident than in forest. And, you know, we can, a trained eye can see that a forest is in need of work. And Mr. Peters and I worked on the Save Our Sequoias Act, and one thing we put in there was an authority that you all are already using. It's an emergency authority where you can go in and do work when an emergency happens. But when you look at a forest and it's overgrown and it's in an arid condition where fires are prevalent, you can almost look at it like a bomb with a fuse on it. And we shouldn't wait till the fire starts to use those emergency authorities. So could you talk a little bit about how the emergency authority has benefited the work on getting more of these hazardous areas treated, and what the benefits of codifying that so that you would have that authority and be insulated from litigation on it?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the question. So when I talked about the efficiencies that we've created in the way that we're doing our NEPA right now, part of it is based on the full use of the authorities we've been given through Congress. And one of those is the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law Emergency Authority. The Secretary authorized us to use that over 27 million acres. We have 37 projects that have been promulgated using that authority. And then we have other authorities like the one that you're talking about that we've used out of our own NEPA regs that allowed us to move in and take action immediately before the fire hit. It's also incredibly helpful sometimes after a fire to remove hazard trees along roads that right now we don't have some clear authorities to do that quickly. And so using those in those spaces have tremendously helped us. If I look at the efficiencies that we've been able to create, it is primarily driven by doing larger projects using all the authorities, whether those are CEs that have been promulgated or emergency authorities, that have basically allowed us to reduce the amount of money we put into NEPA and other environmental compliance, but produce higher quality and more authorizations at the other end, Congressman.
Thank you. When I first came to Congress in 2015 and started working on these wildland fire issues, I've learned from service in the state legislature that if you want to know how something works, go look at the budget. So I did hours upon hours of digging through the Forest Service's budget, and I found something very interesting in it, that at one time the Forest Service sent more money to the Treasury than the Forest Service was appropriated. So the Forest Service was actually, in a sense, making money for the federal government. Now, by the time I got here in 2015, it was way the other direction on that because of the tremendous amount of money spent on fire suppression. And at one point, I thought we should just change the name of the Forest Service to the U.S. Fire Service because most of the funding went to fight fire. And we worked hard to get something called the fire funding fix done so that FEMA funds would be available when firefighting funds were exhausted. And the thought was more management could happen instead of saving all the Forest Service budget to fight fire at the end of the year. We got that done. We've given the Forest Service authorities such as the 20-year stewardship contracting, which unfortunately, to my knowledge, there hasn't been a 20-year stewardship contract issued yet. And I'm still going to continue working on that and pushing on that. But we hear a lot about funding and needs for funding, and I hear everything you're saying about the multi-use aspect of our federal lands. But if we just took the money we were spending to fight fires and use that on forest management, then we wouldn't have to spend so much money on fighting fires. It's like we've got things upside down and backwards. But on the other hand, that forest is valuable. It's got very valuable assets in it. And as you responded to Mr. Stauber, private landowners are trying to make a profit. If the Forest Service wasn't trying to make a profit, just trying to pay the bills so that we could do more management work, it seems like there's a tremendous asset there that, as I said, it's 300 trees per acre and needs to drop down much lower than that. If we had the markets, we could sell that timber to pay for future management. We've got programs like Good Neighbor Authority. I've got a bill on wildlife habitat management that does just that. It takes revenues from Forest Service sales and puts them back into the fund to do more work. Do you see a scenario where instead of Congress having to appropriate more money, where we could actually use the resources we've got to generate the funds so that the Forest Service could pay for all the work that they're doing to keep our forest healthy? It's happened in the past. Why can't it happen again?
Okay, so maybe. I mean, to be realistic here, one, I would just say there's a number of activities that we do. If we were to recover the funds that come from them, it would help pay delivering the program. And it goes beyond forest management. In this one, there is a scenario to get there, but I think that there's a couple things. Attitudes on how we manage our forests, and I'm reflecting public meetings and comments that we get, litigation that we have, towards managing forests through a standard type rotation versus a long-term resiliency, set. I think that is one of the spaces that we find ourselves in public land management is those two spaces, Congressman. And why I bring that up is that both result in our ability to deliver forest products. One results in a continuous delivery of saw logs. And I think our challenge is right now is as we're trying to reduce wildland fire risk and those pressures not to rotate trees, but to do long-term restoration, our ability to provide saw log products as well as remove all the other products at times is pretty challenging. And you can see the consequences of that.
Yeah, and just quick follow-up on that. I'm not talking about plantations and clear cutting. I'm talking about thinning activities that over time can produce perpetual income to the Forest Service, and it's being done on the Ouachita Forest in my district, and it's the healthiest component of the forest that's out there. And you also were seeing it was done to create habitat for the red-cockaded woodpecker. We're seeing more woodpeckers, more songbirds, more quail, more turkey, more deer, and a flush of biodiversity when you open up the forest floor to sunlight. So I think it's not really thinking outside the box. It's looking at how we can use sound science to manage these forests, and they can actually pay their way so that it's not a burden on the taxpayer. And that's something I want to work on as we go forward. I'm way out of time. I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
It's forestry, right? The gentleman yields. I might want to ask a couple questions here and take my 5 minutes, if I may, Mr. French. So I just got done planting the state tree in Wisconsin, a sugar maple, out on the Capitol grounds. What a great day to be able to do that, and we look forward to that being a mighty maple at some point. Maybe we can even tap it for a little maple syrup. So I want to, Mr. French, I want to piggyback a little bit on the chairman's questions there. What's the number one change that could be made to get there? You just used the phrase "to get there," you know, in terms of having more harvest, and I think we're driving at how we had management a few decades ago that was so successful. And in order to get there, what's the number one thing you would change?
Change in the agency or in general?
What's a number one change? As in the position that you're in, let's say you're king for a day in the United States Forest Service, in order to get there, what's the number one change that would help us get there?
I think the number one thing is being able to clearly show people the true costs and consequences of what we're doing, and then being able to prioritize the resources we have towards delivering what those choices are. If you're going to deliver on wildland fire fuels reduction, we can, as the chairman pointed out, most oftentimes, not always, pay for the saw logs to get out. I've got to figure out a way to pay for all the the small diameter and other pieces, because the saw logs don't usually pay for the biomass. If I could make a change, I would figure out a solution that does both. Gives me a way to transport and dispose and utilize biomass in a way that I can also deliver the broader set of saw logs at the same time in this forestry question. That's what I would shift.
So what's the impediment to get that biomass off from the forest floor?
Fuel costs and costs of utilization, and a loss of an integrated set of markets out there, forest markets, that of where you have to take that stuff to.
So in other words, a loss of, for example, I cited in my testimony the loss of sawmills.
That's a big problem, right? It is a part of it, yes.
So the Federal Forest Resource Coalition puts out a quarterly update on how much harvest is coming off from the U.S. Forest Service lands. Do you see that report?
I have seen their reports in the past. I'm not sure if I saw the latest one.
Because what's striking to me is, subsequent to huge amounts of money being authorized to try to get rid of this backlog, to be able to, we were told that this is simply going to take more money to be able to harvest more wood and all the rest. We're actually not seeing that in the data. So what is it going to take to get more harvest off from those federal lands?
So, again, on the wildfire crisis strategy, the focus there is how do you decrease the risk to communities that are threatened by wildfire. And that is going to run the gamut of work that can be from removing chaparral and shrubs all the way to saw logs. And we've been focusing on the communities that are most at risk. Unfortunately, many of those places are places that lack a connected forest products industry. We spend a lot of time trying to connect those two. I understand the criticisms, but what I can say is we increased our fuels reduction last year by more than 1 million acres based on those investments. We've been holding fairly steady on our timber volume outputs. We've been trying to create ways that you connect the two more directly. But I would also say that there should be as much investment in the budget items that are for forest products as there is for fuels. They drive a capacity that does similar but different things at times.
Are you saying that they're not capturing the fuels reduction that you're doing in that data?
No, I'm saying that there are places where we are doing significant fuels reduction that isn't necessarily about removing saw logs.
So it's so the data is not capturing that. So how they're measuring this is, would that be accurate that they're not capturing some of the work that you're doing?
What we are showing, and we will be able to come back to Congress and show this, is what's the overall risk reduction that we're creating to the communities that we're trying to protect? That is a better outcome to look at in terms of overall value of the work we're doing versus how many acres you treat or how much volume we produce. And I say that not to say that we're not wanting to make sure that we create a sustainable amount of volume at any given time. But the investments we've had to reduce wildland fire risk, which primarily came through Bill and IRA, are not necessarily connected. If you're trying to reduce wildland fire risk and some of your most fire-prone communities, at times you're going to be doing it in ways. I'll give you an example, and I know I'm over time, but yesterday I was meeting with a community that is in the exact same predicament we are.
There's nobody here to object.
Go ahead. All right. But, I mean, this is the conversation that I just went through yesterday. They had to dispose of tons and tons of acres of trees because they couldn't figure out how to subsidize the cost to transport them to someplace to be utilized or that for them to be utilized. So if you're going to reduce wildland fire risk to a community that doesn't have infrastructure to use what I think increases the scale, like logging, like timber sales, then the costs are higher per acre and you don't necessarily see those outputs. And this is worth us getting into a deeper conversation, but that's what's going on.
We look forward to having that conversation with you. Are there other agencies that are a problem here also? Because from my understanding, the EPA has been a problem in terms of being able to build a plant specifically in the upper Midwest, possibly even in my home state of Wisconsin, and they have denied the ability to do that, to be able to, because of, they say, emissions concerns.
I'm not aware of that. What I will say is integrated forest products industry is an incredibly important piece for us to reduce wildland fire risk and maintain healthy forests.
If this question is redundant, I apologize. I was planting that maple tree. Is there any scientific reason why forest management projects should be limited to no more than 3,000 acres?
You mean in our categorical exclusions?
Yeah.
Well, part of that was based on what Congress told us. And so when those CEs were promulgated, let's say under the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, that's what Congress said was the limit for something not being significant. For the things that we have promulgated, what we do is we look at our past history of environmental assessments that find that projects are not significant, and we use those to say, here's the acreages that we would say a new CE would make.
Might it be helpful if you can expand that CE, if it would be appropriate for that landscape?
It is always helpful for us to have, okay, here's how I'll answer it. A CE takes us about 143 days to finish and costs about the quarter of what an EA does. An EA takes about 390 days to finish and costs, you know, essentially a third of what an EIS does. And so you always have these scales of efficiencies. And so my answer to you is that we use the best tools we have, whether it's things we've created ourselves or from Congress, to try to hit the most work we can with the resources we have.
If you had the ability to expand beyond 3,000 acres for CEs, might you use that in some projects?
If we had authorities that were greater than our current limits, if we could make it through ESA and other pieces and local collaboration, then of course we'd use those.
What are some of the primary reasons projects today require an EA or an EIS as opposed to a CE? What are a couple primary reasons that?
The most significant piece is that we deal with, there's two, is that the larger the project that you want to authorize, you're usually outside the scope of a categorical exclusion.
So larger than 3,000 acres?
Yes. You know, if we're doing a 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 acre project, and the likelihood that you start to have potentially significant issues rises, whether that is compliance with the National Heritage Protection Act or ESA, or even your local community that is looking at this through a different lens. That those are the sorts of things that start to occur with larger projects.
What would be the impact if there's not a permanent solution to the Cottonwood decision? Can I preface it with a question?
Sure.
Has the Cottonwood decision been a major impediment in getting some projects done?
It increases our costs on a per unit basis in places where we are authorizing projects so that we are guarding ourselves against litigation, and it creates risk. What's that?
Does it significantly increase costs?
Sure.
Like, give me a project that, I mean, did it increase it by 25% or 50%?
So here's the way I would say it. We can do a project in one part of the country where we know that the risk for litigation or under like a Cottonwood type approach, but it's all litigation, will generally be 3 to 4 times less on the environmental compliance side because of the way we do the analysis. And unit costs are probably around half, sometimes more. I mean, that's the business that I work within. And I'm not here to say one way is right or another. I just know if I do a project here, it's going to cost me this. And if I do it over here, it's going to cost me a different amount.
So I just want to hone in, final question here. On unit cost, you said it's up to half. What do you mean by unit cost for being able to remove that wood? Is it a 50% increase in cost, or does it double it?
Doubles it. I mean, I
so it I, doubles the cost of removal as a result of increased litigation.
The level of analysis that we are going to do on an acre in one of those places will be much higher than we may in other places, and that increases those unit costs.
And you've seen an example where it's been double. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, very good. I am way over time, and I appreciate you taking the time, Mr. French, to come here today and testify. It's always good to have you here and provide information from the Forest Service perspective. Thank you for your answers.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. We will now move on to our next panel. I'd like to thank the Deputy Chief for his testimony. While the clerk resets our witness table, I will remind the witnesses that under committee rules, they must limit their oral statements to 5 minutes, but their entire statements will appear in the hearing record. I'd also like to remind our witnesses of the timing lights, which will turn red at the end of your 5-minute statement, and to please remember to turn on your microphone. As with the previous panel, I will allow all witnesses to testify before member questioning.